air of self-importance that went with being the president's secretary. "I shall take the liberty of informing you of the most important political occurrences of our government, or such of them as I may feel myself at liberty to give." The maddening delays and infrequency of the mails forced the eager young man to wait 3 days before he could post his reply to Jefferson. In a letter dated March 10th, Lewis explained, "Not until too late on Friday last to answer by that day's mail did I receive yours of the 23rd ult, asking that I accept the place of your private secretary." He immediately got to the point. "I most cordially acquiesce, and with pleasure accept the office." After profuse thanks for the honor, Lewis promised to get forward to the city of Washington with all possible dispatch. "Rest assured, I shall not relax in my exertions. Receive, I pray you, sir, the most undissembled assurance of the attachment and friendship of your most obedient and very humble servant, Meriwether Lewis." He set off at once, but spring rains, a lame horse, and miserable roads conspired to slow his progress. It took him 3 weeks to get from Pittsburgh to Washington, where he arrived on the afternoon of April 1st. Shortly thereafter, he wrote his friend Thornton Gilmer of Albemarle, "I feel my situation in the president's family an extremely pleasant one. I very little expected that I possessed the confidence of Mr. J. in so far as to have produced on his part a voluntary offer of the office of his private secretary. However, nothing is extraordinary in these days of revolution and reform." He was active in reform. Jefferson had a specific mission in mind when he offered the post to Lewis, who became a key participant in one of the president's most important projects, one of the planks in his election campaign, reducing the size of the army. In a letter of February 23, 1801, to General James Wilkinson, commanding general of the army, asking Wilkinson to release Captain Lewis from active service while allowing him to retain his rank and right to promotion, Jefferson had explained that he had chosen Lewis on the basis of a personal acquaintance with him, owing from his being of my neighborhood. But the president had something more specific in mind. He knew Lewis not only as a neighbor, but as a solid Republican and as an army officer who, because of his responsibilities as paymaster, had traveled extensively throughout the Trans-Appalachian region, visiting the various army posts, and thus a man who knew the officer corps well. Jefferson's somewhat cryptic reference to Lewis's knowledge of the Western country, of the army, and of all its interests and relations was a reference not to an upcoming exploration of the Missouri River country, but to politics. What Jefferson wanted first of all from Lewis was help in reducing the grip of the Federalists on the Army Officer Corps. Jefferson intended to reduce the size of the army by one half. This was good Republican principle and sound policy. The undeclared war with France was over, and relations with the British were quiet. Money could be saved by the government, also solid Republican principle, if the number of officers was cut back, something that made sense in any event because of the way John Adams and the Federalists had swelled the ranks of the officer corps during the war scare of 1798, and again through Adams's midnight appointments in March 1801. If officers were going to be cut, Jefferson figured it should be done, at least to some extent, on the same basis according to which they had been given their commissions, partisan politics. But Jefferson had never worn a uniform. He did not know even the senior, much less the junior officers in the army. He did not know which officers were competent, which were extreme Federalists, which were inferior, which superior. But his young friend Meriwether Lewis knew, and Jefferson could count on him to evaluate the officer corps with complete candor. Thus, Lewis's first task as Jefferson's secretary was to go through a roster from the War Department listing all commissioned officers. Using a simple code of symbols, plus sign, plus sign, plus sign, or zero, zero, or pound sign, etc., Lewis passed a judgment on every officer in the army. There were 11 symbols in all. The first, denote such officers as are of the first class, so esteemed from a superiority of genius and military proficiency. The second showed officers of the second class, respectable. The third listed the same, Republican. The fourth covered officers whose politics Lewis could not positively ascertain. Fifth, officers without politics. 6. Those opposed to the administration, otherwise respectable. 7th, more decisively opposed to the administration. 8th, most violently opposed to the administration and still active in its vilification. 9th, professional soldiers without a political creed. 10th, unworthy of the commissions they bear. Finally, unknown to us. Jefferson did not take a meat axe to the Federalists on Lewis's list. If one puts the list beside the names of the officers dismissed from the service, it is clear that in the winnowing process, military qualifications were given much greater consideration than party preference. Federalist officers rated superior by Lewis retained their commissions. Of those rated acceptable, 7 of 18 were retained. This was good politics as well as good military policy. Jefferson wanted to bring the country together, not make it more divided than it already was. And of course, he hoped to win over at least some Federalists to his cause, so he had to keep some Federalists in the army. But all except one of those noted as most violently opposed to the administration were dropped. Despite the purge, Federalist officers continued to outnumber Republicans by a majority of 140-38. The only senior officer thought to be sympathetic to the Republicans was Wilkinson, and he was notorious for swimming with the tide. Jefferson had not gone as far as his more extreme supporters wished. Secretary of War Henry Dearborn complained, "We have been much more liberal towards them, the Federalists, than they would be towards us, and in future I think we ought to give them measure for measure." Jefferson put it well when he commented, "The army is undergoing a chaste reformation." Lewis had been invaluable in bringing it about on a fair rather than an excessively partisan basis. Beyond his active role in the reduction of the army, Lewis's duties were varied and not particularly exciting. He spent long hours at the writing desk performing menial tasks, such as drawing up a list of all U.S. postmasters, with their locations and compensation, a total of 20 pages. He copied many other routine documents, including a list of prisoners in the Washington jail as of March 29, 1802, an extract of a letter of March 6, 1802, 4 pages of a report on the cost of a naval arsenal on December 4, 1802, and so on. He delivered messages from Jefferson to Congress. It was tedious work, but instructive. Abigail Adams, the first resident of the president's house, called it the Great Castle and hated the place. It was too large, 23 rooms, and basically unfurnished and unfinished. Mrs. Adams complained that it took 30 servants to run the place. The roof leaked. The walls were unplastered. In the nearest stable at 14th and G Streets, John Adams told his successor, were 7 horses and 2 carriages in the stables that were the property of the United States and available for the president's use. Jefferson ran the place with only 11 servants, brought up from Monticello. There were no more powdered wigs, much less ceremony. Washington and Adams, according to Republican critics, had kept up almost a royal court. Jefferson substituted Republican simplicity, to a point. He had a French chef and French wines he personally selected. His salary was $25,000 per year, a princely sum, but the expenses were also great. In 1801, Jefferson spent $6,500 for provisions and groceries, $2,700 for servants, some of whom were liveried, $500 for Lewis's salary, $3,000 for wine. And it turned out he had to buy his own horses. Congress, thinking it an outrage that the government should pay for the president's horses, ordered that the ones Adams had turned over to Jefferson be sold. Adams was so mortified over this action that he left town before the inauguration. Jefferson was a widower. His 2 daughters were married and had their husbands, children, and own affairs to look after. Secretary of State James Madison and his wife, Dolly, stayed with Jefferson in the president's house for several weeks in May 1801, and Dolly Madison often acted as hostess for dinner parties, but essentially the president's house was a bachelor house in the years Lewis lived there. Other than the servants, Jefferson and Lewis were the only residents. On May 28, 1801, shortly after the Madisons took their own residence, Jefferson wrote his daughter Martha, "Captain Lewis and myself are like 2 mice in a church." They ate together, spent the evenings together, usually with guests, and worked closely together, especially on matters concerning the army. Jefferson came to know Lewis as well as he knew any man. He later praised Lewis for, among other attributes, sound understanding and a fidelity to truth. But he also noted, "While he lived with me in Washington, I observed at times sensible depressions of mind." He had seen the same melancholy in Lewis's father, and felt it was a malady that ran in the family. Knowing their constitutional source, I estimated their course by what I had seen in the family. Lewis's depressions, in other words, did not unduly alarm the president or last long, but Jefferson could not help noticing them. Lewis's quarters were in what became the East Room. It contained almost no furniture and was damp, cold, drafty, and depressing. Abigail Adams had hung her wash in it. Life in the president's house, however, was as exciting and rewarding to Lewis as life in the White House has been to most of the young people lucky enough to live or work there in the following two centuries. First of all, there was that daily association with Jefferson. No American has ever surpassed Jefferson, and fewer than a handful have ever equaled him, as friend, teacher, guide, model, leader, companion. Dumas Malone, author of the definitive multi-volume biography, called Jefferson "this extraordinarily versatile and seemingly inexhaustible man." For Lewis, left fatherless as a child, 31 years younger than Jefferson, the president was all that and a father figure as well. Lewis took his meals with the president and was almost always present when he entertained, which was 4 or 5 nights a week. The dinner parties were small affairs, usually 2 or 3 guests, sometimes 6 to 8, never more than a dozen. One of the guests, Malan Dickerson, 4 years older than Lewis, was a lawyer from Philadelphia and a politician who later became governor of New Jersey and then a cabinet officer. He noted in a letter that Jefferson is accused of being very slovenly in his dress, and to be sure, he is not very particular in that respect, but however he may neglect his person, he takes good care of his table. No man in America keeps a better. "You drink as you please and converse at your ease," another guest reported. The table was an oval one, encouraging a general conversation. The talk flowed freely on any subject that interested Jefferson, which meant practically all subjects. But the concentration was on natural science, geography, natural philosophy, Indian affairs, and, of course, politics. Jefferson had promised Lewis that if he accepted the appointment, he would "know and be known to characters of influence in the affairs of our country, and give you the advantage of their wisdom." And that was exactly what happened. Lewis sat with the Republican high command, including such regulars as Madison, Dearborn, Secretary of the Treasury Albert Gallatin, and Attorney General Levi Lincoln. Non-political guests included the poet and journalist Joel Barlow, the artist Charles Wilson Peel, the author Thomas Paine, the poet Philip Freneau, and other writers, scientists, and travelers. Lewis and Dickerson, who met at Jefferson's table, became good friends. Lewis visited him in Philadelphia, where young bachelor Dickerson moved in the highest social circles. Dickerson kept a diary with such entries as, "Friday 14th, May 1802. A fine day. Captain Lewis and others dined with me. Went to see Rennie's Deceptions. Much pleased." Rennie was a magician and ventriloquist. "Wednesday 19th, May. Cloudy and rainy part of the day. Cold at evening. Spent the evening at Mademoiselle Free's with Captain L. Friday 21st. Clear in morning, rained very hard p.m., rode out with Captain L. to Dr. Logan's, dinner there, retired at evening." George Logan was a physician and U.S. senator and a founder of the American Philosophical Society, in which Dickerson was active and Jefferson was a member. It was a feature of Jefferson's personality that he reached out to men older and younger than he, men with different life experiences who could bring to his table perspectives and information foreign to him. Henry Adams wrote, "Three more agreeable men than Jefferson, James Madison, and Albert Gallatin were never collected round the dinner table of the White House, and their difference in age was enough to add zest to their friendship." Jefferson was 58 years of age in 1801, Madison 50, Gallatin 40, and Lewis 27. Lewis's activities with Dickerson added to the list of famous men with whom he visited. Monday 24th, a charming day, rode with Captain L. to Wilmington on a visit to John Dickinson. He was from home. We put up at Craig's. John Dickinson was the revolutionary pamphleteer who wrote The Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania in 1768. That same week, Lewis and Dickerson dined with Pennsylvania Governor Thomas McKean, former member of the Continental Congress and signer of the Declaration of Independence. On a visit to Philadelphia a year later, Lewis joined Dickerson for dinner with Henry Sheaf, a merchant who had been the provider of wine and sundries for President Washington when the capital was in Philadelphia. Clearly, Captain Lewis was moving in elite circles. In August 1802, Jefferson retired to Monticello for a two-month vacation. Lewis accompanied him and stayed at the Clabbert House 3 miles east of Monticello on the estate called Franklin, home of Ben Franklin's grandson, William Bache. Being there allowed Lewis to visit his mother, brothers, and sister at Locust Hill and to attend dinners at Monticello. One Albemarle planter, Lewis's schoolboy friend Peachy Gilmer, called the company that gathered at Jefferson's table "the most accomplished and elegant society that has been anywhere at any time within my knowledge in Virginia." Meriwether Lewis was too sometimes with us, sometimes absent. In Washington, Lewis was on the move much of every day, carrying messages and invitations, gathering information for his boss. He had the honor of copying and then delivering Jefferson's first State of the Union address to Congress. This broke the precedent set by Washington and Adams, who had delivered their speeches in person. Jefferson thought that practice a bit monarchical. Besides, he disliked making public speeches. The summer of 1802 was marked by a juicy scandal full of invective and slander, leaks from men in high places, hush money, blackmail, and charges of immoral sexual conduct and miscegenation by Jefferson. Meriwether Lewis was involved in his capacity as aide and messenger for the president. The scandal had its origins in 1798, when Jefferson leaked some information on foreign affairs to a Richmond journalist named James Thompson Callender. It was not new or secret information, but it had received little publicity, and Jefferson wanted it known, although he did not want his having supplied it to Callender to be known. He asked Callender to attribute what he had supplied to an unnamed source, which was done. Jefferson then read some of the page proof of a book Callender was writing, The Prospect Before Us, for the 1800 presidential campaign, and approved of what he saw. He wrote Callender, "Such papers cannot fail to produce the best effect. They inform the thinking part of the nation." But the work as a whole turned out to be full of such spleen and scurrility that Jefferson disapproved of it and feared its extreme language would help the Federalists and hurt the Republicans. For example, Callender called Washington the Grand Lama of Federal Adoration, the Immaculate Divinity of Mount Vernon, and described Adams as a hideous hermaphroditical character which has neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. Callender was arrested for his words, tried before Supreme Court Justice and Arch-Federalist Samuel Chase on charges of violating the Sedition Act of 1798, found guilty, fined $200, and thrown into prison. By the time Jefferson became president, Callender had paid his fine and served his 9-month sentence. Jefferson gave him a pardon. He could do no other, not so much because Callender had been his supporter in the election, as because he and his party had denounced the Sedition Act, along with the Alien Act, as unconstitutional in the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. When he granted the pardon, Jefferson also ordered the fine returned to Callender, who was pleading poverty and simultaneously demanding the postmaster position in Richmond. But a series of red tape delays held up the repayment. Callender came to Washington in May 1801 to demand his money. He accused Jefferson of going back on his word and said, among other things, that it would have been advantageous to Jefferson's reputation if his head had been cut off 5 minutes before he began his inaugural address. In a letter of May 29th to James Monroe, the governor of Virginia who had suggested raising the $200 by private contributions in order to get Callender to shut up, Jefferson related what happened next. Understanding he, Callender, was in distress, I sent Captain Lewis to him with $50 to inform him we were making some inquiries as to his fine, which would take a little time, and lest he should suffer in the meantime I had sent him, etc. But Callender wanted that postmastership, not a paltry $50. Jefferson's report to Monroe continued, "His language to Captain Lewis was very high-toned. He intimated that he was in possession of things which he could and would make use of in a certain case, that he received the $50 not as a charity but a due, in fact as hush money, that I knew what he expected, namely a certain office, and more to this effect. Such a misconstruction of my charities puts an end to them forever. He knows nothing of me which I am not willing to declare to the world myself." Jefferson absolutely refused to make the appointment or have anything further to do with Callender. Monroe regretted that Lewis had handed the money over to the man, although it is not clear whether Lewis did so before or after Callender made his threats. Callender went back to Richmond, where he switched political sides and began publishing scurrilous attacks on Jefferson in the Richmond Recorder. These were picked up by Federalist papers around the country, including Hamilton's organ, the New York Evening Post. In the summer of 1802, the vengeful campaign of the embittered Callender reached its crescendo. Jefferson was deeply hurt, not so much by what Callender charged as by the readiness of men he respected, including Hamilton, to believe the slanders. "With the aid of a lying renegade from republicanism," he wrote, "the Federalists have opened all their sluices of calumny." The charges were: Jefferson had a slave mistress, Black Sally, who had borne him several children. Jefferson had approached another man's wife when the man was away. Jefferson had cheated on a debt. The first charge lives on. The second charge was true and was later admitted to by Jefferson. The third was false. Within a year, Callender had fallen into a 3-foot pool of water, dead drunk, and drowned. The Federalists tried to pound Jefferson with the charges in the election of 1804, without effect. By that time, Lewis had left Washington. Beyond vicious partisanship and vile political journalism, what had Meriwether Lewis learned in the first 2 years of his life in Washington? A great deal about practical politics, including the politics of the U.S. Army. He was an insider's insider in Washington, privy to the president's hopes, plans, ambitions, and secrets. He got to know and be known to the elite of Washington and Philadelphia. His biographer Richard Dillon wrote that the president's house served as an ideal finishing school for Lewis. Further, he advanced his scientific education. He was introduced to new instruments of navigation. He listened to discussions of the geography of North America and the world, and of the Indians of the United States. He heard experts on the birds and animals and plant life of the eastern United States, and speculation on what lay beyond the Mississippi River. In addition to the school of the practical and scientific, he greatly expanded his understanding of philosophy, literature, and history. He read extensively in Jefferson's library, and somehow, from someone, who else could it have been but Jefferson, he learned how to write. A distinct difference is evident between Lewis's writing before 1800 and after 1802. His sense of pace, his timing, his word choice, his rhythm, his similes and analogies all improved. He sharpened his descriptive powers. He learned how to catch a reader up in his own response to events and places, to express his emotions naturally and effectively. Though his sentences remained convoluted and cried out for punctuation, he managed to carry them off by retaining a flow of narrative interspersed with personal observations and reactions, all held together by using the right phrase at the precise moment in an arrangement of words that stands the ultimate test of being read aloud and making perfect sense, while catching the sights and sounds and drama and emotion of the moment in a way that can be compared to the stream of consciousness of James Joyce or William Faulkner, or the run-on style of Gertrude Stein. Only better, because he was not making anything up, but describing what he saw, heard, said, and did. Lewis was able, through his writing, to take us 2 centuries later to the unexplored Missouri River, Rocky Mountain, and Oregon wilderness country of 1804-6, to meet Indian tribes untouched by European influence, to paint their portraits in words that capture the economic, political, and social conditions of their lives, along with their vibrancy, savagery, beliefs, habits, manners, and customs in a way never since surpassed and seldom matched. The journals he wrote are among his greatest achievements and constitute a priceless gift to the American people. All thanks, apparently, to lessons learned from Mr. Jefferson during his 2 years of intimate contact with the president in his house. Chapter 6. The Origins of the Expedition, 1750-1802. Jefferson's interest in exploring the country between the Mississippi River and the Pacific Ocean ran back a full half-century. His father had been a member of the Loyal Land Company, which had been awarded by the Crown some 800,000 acres west of the Appalachian Mountains. In 1750, one member of the company, Thomas Walker, founder of the town of Charlottesville, led a small party over the mountains to locate lands. In his travels, he crossed the Cumberland Gap. 3 years later, 10-year-old Thomas Jefferson's teacher, the Reverend James Maury, made plans to explore farther west for the Loyal Company. In January 1756, Maury wrote, "Some persons were to be sent in search of that river Missouri in order to discover whether it had any communication with the Pacific Ocean. They were to follow the river if they found it, and exact reports of the country they passed through, the distances they traveled, what worth of navigation those rivers and lakes afforded, etc." Thomas Walker was once again chosen to lead the expedition, but the French and Indian War intervened before he could get started. Nothing came of the plan after the war. In the decade following the winning of independence, there were 4 American plans to explore the West. Jefferson was the instigator of 3 of them. Within weeks of the conclusion of the Revolutionary War, Jefferson wrote General George Rogers Clark, the man who had won the Old Northwest for the United States, to report that some British capitalists had subscribed a very large sum of money for exploring the country from the Mississippi to California. They pretend it is only to promote knowledge. I am afraid they have thoughts of colonizing into that quarter. Some of us have been talking here in a feeble way of making the attempt to search that country. How would you like to lead such a party? General Clark replied, "It is what I think we ought to do." Not, however, the way Jefferson proposed to do it. Clark warned that sending a large party, as Jefferson intended, would be a mistake. "Large parties will never answer the purpose. They will alarm the Indian nations they pass through. 3 or 4 young men well qualified for the task might perhaps complete your wishes at a very trifling expense." He thought it would take 4 or 5 years, and regretted that his own business affairs precluded his going. Again, nothing happened. 2 years later, in 1785, Jefferson was in Paris as minister to France. There he learned that Louis XVI was sending out an expedition to the Pacific Northwest under the command of Jean-François de Galop, Comte de La Pérouse. The French government said the objective was strictly scientific, but Jefferson knew at once that La Pérouse was looking for something more than the Northwest Passage. He wrote on August 14th, "They, the French, give out that the object is merely for the improvement of our knowledge. Their loading and some other circumstances appear to me to indicate some other design, perhaps that of colonizing on the west coast of America, or perhaps to establish 1 or more factories there for the fur trade." He added that the real question was whether the French were yet weaned from their desire to have colonies in North America. Admiral John Paul Jones reported to him that they had not, that the La Pérouse expedition was preparing the way for French fur trade and colonization on the northwestern coast. The following summer, 1786, Jefferson met John Ledyard, who had sailed with Captain Cook and, as a consequence, was the first American to set foot in the Pacific Northwest. A born wanderer, a great talker, intense, dynamic, he convinced Jefferson that he could travel by land from Moscow to easternmost Siberia, cross the Bering Sea on a Russian fur trade vessel, then walk across the North American continent and eventually march into the capital to announce that he had arrived to report on the West. Ledyard proposed to do this with 2 dogs. Jefferson was supportive. Ledyard set forth. He made it to Siberia, where the absurd idea died when Ledyard was arrested by Empress Catherine the Great and sent back to Poland. La Perouse, meanwhile, had sailed around South America, come up to the northwestern coast, taken observations and scouted for trading posts, and set sail for home. In January 1788, he made port in Botany Bay, Australia. When he left Botany, he vanished. The wreckage of his vessels was found 40 years later on an island north of the New Hebrides. In 1790, United States Secretary of War Henry Knox tried to mount a secret Missouri River reconnaissance. In Knox's view, an enterprising officer with a non-commissioned officer well acquainted with living in the woods and perfectly capable of describing rivers and countries, accompanied by 4 or 5 hardy Indians, would, in my opinion, be the best mode of obtaining the information requested. General Hosiah Harmar nominated Lieutenant John Armstrong for the command of the expedition, but warned Knox that it seems very much too adventurous. The governor of the Northwest Territory, Arthur St. Clair, was equally blunt. He told Knox, "It is, sir, I believe, at present, altogether impracticable." Lieutenant Armstrong gave it a try, but by the time he reached the Mississippi, he was ready to admit, "This is a business much easier planned than executed." Knox had said that the pocket compasses and pencils and papers would do for making maps and recording discoveries, a mark of how little he understood the problem. Armstrong, after reaching the Mississippi, made a list of items any exploring party would have to have, starting with oilcloth to secure the papers from the elements and including proper writing instruments and scientific tools for measurements. A tent would also help. He sent in his expense account. "For himself and servant, totaling $110.39. He never got to the west bank of the Mississippi. In 1792, Jefferson had another idea on how to explore the west. On May 11th of that year, the American sea captain Robert Gray had sailed his Columbia into the estuary of the Columbia River. Later that month, he met and traded information with Captain George Vancouver, who was making an official voyage of discovery of the Pacific coast for the British government. The discovery of the Great River of the West established the mouth of the Columbia at 124 degrees of longitude and the latitude at 46 degrees. From the results of James Cook's third voyage in 1780, Jefferson had a rough idea of the extent of the continent. With the Gray and Vancouver information, the knowledge was exact. The continent was about 3,000 miles wide. Jefferson was spurred, not depressed, by the information. He proposed to the American Philosophical Society of Philadelphia that a subscription be undertaken to engage an explorer to lead an overland expedition to the Pacific. Big donors, led by George Washington, Robert Morris, and Alexander Hamilton, came in on the subscription, ensuring its success. Washington's pledge came with a matching challenge. "I readily add my mite to the project and do authorize you to place me among and upon a footing with the respectable sums which may be subscribed." With such help, by January 23, 1793, the American Philosophical Society was in a position to offer £1,000 to the explorer who could make it to the Pacific and back and report on what he saw. As noted, 18-year-old Meriwether Lewis volunteered to lead the expedition, but Jefferson passed him off as obviously too young and insufficiently trained. He chose instead the French botanist André Michaud. Jefferson wrote the instructions for Michaud and went over them with Washington. Since Hamilton and other officials were also involved, the instructions can be said to represent the motives, expectations, and hopes of the founding fathers toward the North American West, 10 years after independence was recognized in the Treaty of Paris and at the beginning of the second term of the Washington administration. The instructions were dated April 30, 1793. The first purpose, Jefferson wrote, was to find the shortest and most convenient route of communication between the U.S. and the Pacific Ocean within the temperate latitudes. Since that was almost certain to be the Missouri River, it has therefore been declared as a fundamental object of the subscription, not to be dispensed with, that this river should be considered and explored. Because the country belonged to Spain, not the United States, Michaud should cross the Mississippi somewhere far enough north of the Spanish garrison in St. Louis to avoid the risk of being stopped. He should then march west until he struck the Missouri, follow it to the mountains, get over them, and ascend the Columbia River to the Pacific. Beyond the search for the all-water route across the continent, Jefferson told Michaud that as he proceeded, he should take notice of the country you pass through, its general face, soil, river, mountains, its productions, animal, vegetable, and mineral, so far as they may be new to us and may also be useful, the latitude of places, the names, numbers, and dwellings of the inhabitants, and such particularities as you can learn of them. Jefferson had selected Michaud because he was a trained scientist. Botany, astronomy, mineralogy, and ethnology were among the subjects he had studied. Throughout, the instructions emphasized practical, useful knowledge. There was no hint of encouraging exploration for its own sake, or merely to satisfy curiosity about what was out there. This was a true enlightenment venture. Geography was what most interested the subscribers. Ignorance of the country through which you are to pass and confidence in your judgment, zeal, and discretion, Jefferson wrote, prevent the society from attempting more minute instructions, and even from exacting rigorous observance of those already given, except, indeed, what is the first of all objects, that you seek for and pursue that route which shall form the shortest and most convenient communication between the higher parts of the Missouri and the Pacific Ocean. Beyond the fur trade and other commerce, beyond the acquisition of knowledge, Jefferson and the subscribers wanted to tie the two coasts together, using the Missouri-Columbia waterway to form the knot, in order to create a continent-wide empire for the United States. It was a breathtaking vision. It had, however, an anticlimactic ending. Michaud got started in June 1793, but he had scarcely reached Kentucky when Jefferson discovered that he was a secret agent of the French Republic, whose chief aim was to raise a Western force to attack Spanish possessions beyond the Mississippi. At Jefferson's insistence, the French government recalled Michaud. Over the following decade, Jefferson neither spoke nor wrote about the West. Partly this was because he was so busy with politics and his other duties, but it had also become obvious that the West could not be explored by private subscription and that the federal government could not afford to sponsor an expedition. Further, conditions in the country to be explored were so totally unknown that there could be no agreement on how many men it would take, what they would need, how long it would last. But there was no hurry, for as long as Louisiana was in Spanish hands and Ohio River Valley pioneers had access to the wharves of New Orleans, the United States could afford to wait. Spain was old and decrepit, growing weaker each year. America was young and dynamic, growing stronger every day. The people who were going to transform the Mississippi Valley, from its source to New Orleans, into farms and villages would come from the United States, not from Spain. Time would come soon enough to take Louisiana from the hapless Spanish. In the spring of 1801, however, Jefferson learned of the secret treaties between France, read Napoleon, and Spain, read Napoleon's brother, that had transferred Louisiana from Spain back to France. It was called a retrocession. Jefferson was greatly alarmed. As he put it in one of his more famous passages, there is on the globe one single spot, the possessor of which is our natural and habitual enemy. It is New Orleans, through which the produce of 3/8 of our territory must pass to market. As long as the Spanish were in possession, the United States was willing to wait before asserting sovereignty. But revolutionary France? Napoleonic France? Expansionist France? Never. Often derided as a hopelessly romantic Francophile, Jefferson was a hard-headed practitioner of real politic on this one. The day that France takes possession of New Orleans fixes the sentence which is to restrain her forever within her low watermark, he warned, because from that moment we must marry ourselves to the British fleet and nation. He let the French know of his resolve. He suggested that Napoleon cede Louisiana to the United States to eliminate the possibility of war between the former allies, a war which Jefferson warned would annihilate France on the ocean. And he flatly declared that his government would consider any attempt to land French troops in Louisiana a cause for war. That was the kind of blunt talk Americans liked to have their president use when it came to America's national interests in a clash with any foreign nation. Also persuasive was that it was based on facts. Napoleon's expeditionary force was being devastated in Santo Domingo. It was obvious France could not reconquer that colony, much less send an army to New Orleans. The British and Americans in combination would have sunk the French navy and merchant fleet. Napoleon could not defend what he owned. He could only lose in Louisiana. Why not give it to the United States and be done with the problem, and in the process re-establish the alliance between the two countries? But Napoleon had not become Emperor of France by giving things away. Though he agreed with the logic, he would rather sell than give. The Spanish, still in command in New Orleans, waiting for the French to arrive and take possession, had meanwhile withdrawn the right of deposit, the right to offload goods at the piers in New Orleans, sell them, and then reload onto sailing vessels. The immediate effect was minor. Americans could still offload directly from raft or keelboat to ships in the port or pay fees, and the Spanish gave a solid reason. Smuggling had gotten completely out of hand. But decisions about Louisiana could only be made by Napoleon. Jefferson instructed the American minister in Paris, Robert Livingston, to negotiate for a tract of land on the lower Mississippi for use as a port, or, failing this, to obtain an irrevocable guarantee of the right of deposit. To reinforce Livingston, Jefferson began working on a plan to send James Monroe over to Paris as a minister plenipotentiary with specific instructions for the purchase of New Orleans for $2 million. As he talked this up among Republican leaders, Jefferson indicated he would be willing to ask Congress for up to $10 million for New Orleans. And why not? It would be cheaper than a war, and quicker. It would keep America out of an alliance with the British, the very thought of which to these Revolutionary War veterans was mortifying. It would certainly be constitutional. There was no other single thing the federal government could do that would more exactly meet its charge to improve commerce. The thought that Napoleon might be willing to sell all of Louisiana had not occurred to anyone. It was not the French who got Jefferson to start another project for an exploring expedition across the West. The retrocession had nothing to do with it, but the British. Alexander Mackenzie was a young Scotsman in the fur trade out of Montreal, working for the Northwest Company. In 1787, he was posted to a wild trading post on the west end of Lake Athabasca, in what is now northern Alberta, at 60 degrees of latitude. Though he imported enough of the comforts of civilization to Fort Chipewyan so that it was called the Athens of the North, another part of him yearned not for what had been left behind, but rather what lay ahead. In 1789, he led a small party to Great Slave Lake. On the river that now bears his name, he set out for the sea. But the river swung to the north, and Mackenzie made tidal water on the shores of the Arctic Ocean, not the Pacific. Undeterred, the next year Mackenzie tried again. He wintered at the Northwest Company's westernmost post, Fort Fork, on the Peace River. From there, on May 9, 1793, he set out. Accompanying him was his fellow Scot Alexander Mackay, 6 French-Canadian voyagers, and 2 Indians, plus a ton and a half of provisions. Within the month, he had crossed the continental divide at a place where it was just 3,000 feet high and easily portaged. Mackenzie reported to the Governor General of Canada, "We carried over the height of land, which is only 700 yards broad, that separates those waters. The one empties into the northern Atlantic Ocean, and the other into the western." Mackenzie got on to the Fraser River, which he mistakenly thought was the northern tributary of the Columbia, but abandoned it when it became impassable and struck out overland for the coast. 13 days later, he made it to salt water in the northern reaches of the Strait of Georgia. He camped that night atop a steep, overhanging rock. Using a makeshift paint of vermilion and hot grease, he inscribed on the rock, "Alexander Mackenzie, from Canada, by land, the 22nd of July, 1793. The British had their claim on the Northwestern Empire. Mackenzie got the latitude and longitude of the place. He worked out the latitude using his sextant, which measured the height of the sun above the horizon. Knowing the moment the sun crossed the local meridian made it possible for him to compute how far north of the equator he was. Longitude was much more difficult, although easy in theory. The Earth turns 360 degrees every 24 hours without variation, meaning that the passage of time is also a measure of distance from some arbitrary starting point. By 1793, Greenwich, England, down the Thames River from London, was becoming firmly established as a conventional marker for zero longitude. In 4 minutes, the turning Earth moves 1 degree in longitude. It is relatively easy to calculate longitude if the explorer knows precisely when it is noon in Greenwich and what time it is where he is standing. But it is almost impossibly difficult to calculate longitude if you can't tell the time, in either Greenwich or the wilderness. Englishman John Harrison had invented a clock that was reliable and portable, making it possible to know both times. Captain James Cook had used the Harrison chronometer in the Pacific Ocean in 1775, proving its superiority. But the rigors of overland journeys were too much for such delicate instruments. They got banged around, they got dust in them, so land explorers relied on the telescope and astronomy. Mackenzie picked out Jupiter with his telescope and noted the time when the moons Io and Ganymede disappeared behind the planet. From table showing the times of the same events from Greenwich, Mackenzie computed a longitude of 128.2 degrees west, which was almost a degree, or 40 miles, off. He realized he had been most fortunate. A few cloudy days would have prevented me from ascertaining the final longitude of it. Clouds were always the bane of the navigator. Back at Fort Chipewyan, Mackenzie tried to prepare his journal for publication, but he fell into a depression. His biographer writes that this was his second attempt to find a practical commercial route to the Pacific, and it was at least in part a failure. He had reached the Pacific, but he knew his route could not be used for trade. He left Canada that year and never came back. Mackenzie's account was not published until 1801 in London. It was probably ghost-written, for Mackenzie was not learned enough to have written the book in its published form. The title was Voyages from Montreal on the River St. Lawrence through the continent of North America to the frozen and Pacific Ocean. Jefferson ordered a copy as soon as he heard of the book's existence, but did not have one in his hands until the summer of 1802. He was at Monticello, Lewis was with him, and when the book finally arrived, they devoured it. If the news that the British were exploring overland to the Pacific was a bit of a shock and most unwelcome, it was more than balanced by Mackenzie's evidence that, although there was only a one-day portage over a low mountain pass to a westward flowing river, that river was not navigable. But then Mackenzie had been 5 full degrees north of the Columbia when he struck the coast. If the mountains 400 miles south were similar to those he crossed, the portage would also be similar. In their minds, Jefferson and Lewis saw the Rockies as resembling the Appalachians in height and breadth. That image was greatly reinforced by Mackenzie. Geographer-historian John Logan Allen, in his seminal work, Passage Through the Garden, Lewis and Clark and the Image of the American Northwest, notes that Mackenzie said in effect that the way to the Pacific lay open and easy. According to Professor Allen, it was this simple fact of imaginary geography that gave birth to the Lewis and Clark expedition. Through those hot August days of 1802 at Monticello, Jefferson and Lewis read and talked about little else than Mackenzie. Although Mackenzie stressed that his had been a long, painful, and perilous journey, and although things had turned out badly for Mackenzie, Lewis saw a competitive challenge and an opportunity to act out his life's dream. Anything the British could do, he could do better. It was easy to point to mistakes or shortcomings in the Mackenzie expedition. He had been on a strictly commercial venture with a single purpose only, to find a practicable route for the fur trade. He had collected few specimens, made few descriptions, in general did not advance knowledge of the plant, animal, mineral, or Indian life of the country. Although nearly every sentence in the book was a magnet to Lewis, what struck hardest was the line, Alexander Mackenzie, from Canada, by land. This raised the matter of national honor. The name painted on that rock on the Pacific coast was a direct, open, irresistible challenge. It was also a warning that if the United States did not get going, it would lose the Western Empire to the British before the game was well underway. The sentences that most struck Jefferson were in Mackenzie's final Geographical Review, in which he urged Great Britain to develop a land passage to the Pacific for trade with Asia. He knew it could not be the Fraser or any other river north of the Columbia, which was the most northern situation fit for colonization and suitable to the residence of a civilized people. By opening this intercourse between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, and forming regular establishments through the interior and at both extremes, as well as along the coasts and islands, the entire command of the fur trade of North America might be obtained from latitude 48. North to the pole, except that portion of it which the Russians have in the Pacific, in Alaska. To this may be added the fishing in both seas and the markets of the four quarters of the globe. No wonder the Northwest Company liked Mackenzie. He thought big, and he thought like a businessman. The fire he lit, however, was not under the company or the British government, but under Jefferson. The news that the British were threatening to set up shop in the Northwest galvanized Jefferson into manic activity and changed Meriwether Lewis's life overnight. Sometime late that summer, or in the fall of 1802, it is impossible to tell even what week, much less the moment, President Jefferson informed Captain Lewis that he would command an expedition to the Pacific. Or Captain Lewis talked President Jefferson into giving him the command. We don't know when or how Jefferson made his decision that there would be an American answer to Mackenzie and that Lewis would lead it. Evidently, he consulted no one, asked no one for advice, entertained no nominees or volunteers other than Lewis. This was the most important and the most coveted command in the history of exploration of North America. Jefferson was confident that he had the right man under his roof. Later, Jefferson explained why he chose Lewis rather than a qualified scientist. It was impossible to find a character who, to a complete science in botany, natural history, mineralogy, and astronomy, joined the firmness of constitution and character, prudence, habits adapted to the woods, and a familiarity with the Indian manners and character requisite for this undertaking. All the latter qualities Captain Lewis has. That was not to say Lewis was ignorant of science. Further, Lewis had demonstrated a remarkable ability to learn, especially with Jefferson as his teacher. Jefferson's library at Monticello was the most extensive in the world on the subject of the geography of the North American continent. Lewis had the run of the library. He consulted maps and conferred with Jefferson over them. In Professor Allen's words, "It must be assumed that he and the President talked at great length about the nature of the country west of the Mississippi and the possible character of the speculative passage to Pacific waters." From his later journals, we know that Lewis read Captain James Cook's A Voyage to the Pacific Ocean, London, 1784, the account of Cook's third voyage to the Pacific Northwest. It almost certainly was at this time that he read it. He also read Antoine Seymour Lepage Duprat's The History of Louisiana or of the Western Parts of Virginia and Carolina, London, 1763, and took it with him on his expedition. He read other books and consulted more maps. He took botany lessons from Jefferson, who taught as they walked through the gardens at Monticello or later in the season along the banks of the Potomac. Jefferson once said no country gentleman should be without what amuses every step he takes into his fields, and he ranked botany with the most valuable of sciences. Whether we consider its subjects as furnishing the principal subsistence of life to man and beast, delicious varieties for our tables, the adornments of our flower borders, or medicaments for our bodies. Jefferson introduced Lewis to the Linnaean system of affixing binomial Latin names, and taught him enough to use the system in the field. He taught Lewis how to use a sextant and tried to teach him the use of the equatorial theodolite. Lewis rightly believed that he had Jefferson's complete confidence. They had a cipher so that they could communicate secretly, which might be necessary, since Jefferson had told Lewis privately that he would be sending the expedition into foreign territory. The Spanish might protest. They talked about the Indians along the Missouri, of their attachment to the British trading posts north of the Missouri, and of the possibility of bringing the tribes into the American orbit. They talked of finding the Welsh Indians on the Missouri. They talked flora and fauna, mountains and rivers. They talked about the size of the party, whether too many would alarm the Indians to the point of active war, whether too few would invite an Indian attack to seize the rifles and supplies. They agreed on the basic need to bring back accurate records, descriptions, and maps. In short, between the time Mackenzie's book arrived at Monticello and December 1802, Jefferson gave Lewis a college undergraduate's introduction to the liberal arts, North American geography, botany, mineralogy, astronomy, and ethnology. In the fall of 1802, back in the president's house, Jefferson and Lewis continued their preparations for the expedition. While Lewis drew up an estimate of expenses to present to Congress as part of a request for an appropriation, Jefferson began to widen the circle of those who knew about the proposal. The first outsider brought into the plan was Carlos Martinez de Irujo, the Spanish minister to the United States. Martinez was married to the daughter of Governor Thomas McKean of Pennsylvania and was on friendly terms with Jefferson. In fact, had found a cook for the president. On December 2nd, Martinez reported to the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Madrid that Jefferson had asked him, in a frank and confident tone, if our court would take it badly that the Congress decree the formation of a group of travelers who would form a small caravan and go and explore the course of the Missouri River with no other view than the advancement of the geography. Jefferson, Martinez reported, had explained that, as a strict constructionist of the Constitution, he could not ask Congress for an appropriation for a mere literary expenditure, so he intended to lie to Congress and pass the expedition off as one designed to promote commerce, which was a power given Congress by the Constitution. At this point, Jefferson was into a third or fourth degree of indirection. Martinez cut him off. I replied to him that making use of the same frankness with which he honored me, I would take the liberty of telling him that an expedition of this nature could not fail to give umbrage to our government. Jefferson could not see why. The only subject would be to fill in the map, which would benefit everyone. Martinez did not believe him, any more than Jefferson had believed the British in 1783 about the purposes of their proposed exploration, or Louis XVI about the purposes of the La Perouse expedition of 1785. Martinez told his government, "The president has been all his life a man of letters, very speculative and a lover of glory, and it would be possible he might attempt to perpetuate the fame of his administration by discovering the way by which the Americans may some day extend their population and their influence up to the coast of the South Sea, Pacific Ocean." Martinez knew his man. Undeterred by Martinez's negative reaction and his refusal to give Captain Lewis a passport, Jefferson plunged ahead. In the late winter of 1802-3, he got a passport for Lewis from the British minister and another from the French. Simultaneously, he moved forward with the Monroe Project to purchase New Orleans from Napoleon. Lewis, meanwhile, completed his estimate. He based it on the cost for a party of one officer and 10 to 12 soldiers, surely reflecting a decision he and Jefferson had made together about the ideal size, and kept it as low as possible to avoid congressional criticism. With $696 for Indian presents as the largest expenditure, and other large sums for provisions, mathematical instruments, arms, medicines, and a boat, it came to $2,500 on the nose. Jefferson put a request for that amount into his first draft of his annual message to Congress in December 1802. When Treasury Secretary Gallatin saw the draft, he suggested that the request be confined to a separate, later, confidential message, as it contemplates an expedition out of our own territory. Jefferson agreed and sent up a special, secret message to Congress on January 18, 1803. Even then, he buried the request in a discourse on the Indian problem, couching it in terms of commerce. "The River Missouri and the Indians inhabiting it," he said, "are not as well known as is rendered desirable by their connection with the Mississippi, and consequently with us. It is, however, understood that the country on that river is inhabited by numerous tribes who furnish great supplies of furs and pelty to the trade of another nation carried on in a high latitude through an infinite number of portages and lakes shut up by ice through a long season. The Missouri, traversing an area with a moderate climate, might offer a better source of transportation, possibly with a single portage from the Western Ocean." Those congressmen who were listening hard got the clear message. We can steal the fur trade from the British. It would not cost much. One officer and a dozen soldiers, who would have to be paid regardless, could explore the whole line, even to the Western Ocean. They could talk with the Indians, persuade them to accept American traders, agree on the sites for trading posts. They could do all of this in 2 summers and for a pittance. Jefferson concluded, "The interests of commerce place the principal object within the constitutional powers and care of Congress, and that it should incidentally advance the geographical knowledge of our own continent cannot but be an additional gratification." He then asked for an appropriation of $2,500 for the purpose of extending the external commerce of the U.S. There was some muttering from the Federalists, who always resented and resisted spending money on the West, but they were too badly outnumbered to be effective. Congress approved the whole package. The $2,500 went down easy compared with Jefferson's request the previous week, which had been for an open-ended, up to $9,375,000, appropriation for the purchase of New Orleans. The Federalists had protested over the amount of money and because some of the high Federalists were clamoring for war against France. But the Republicans held firm, and the Congress made the appropriation. The President selected Monroe to go to Paris to join Livingston in the negotiations. If Jefferson saw the link between the January 12th and the January 18th appropriation bills, he never mentioned it to anyone, except perhaps Lewis. As soon as the appropriation for Western exploration passed, as Jefferson recalled it, Captain Lewis immediately renewed his solicitations to have the direction of the party. Perhaps command really was still an open question. More likely, Jefferson was pretending that until Congress had authorized the expedition, he had made no choice of a leader. Whatever his reason for the remark, Jefferson never hesitated to confirm Lewis's appointment. Jefferson, by this time, had spent 2 full years with Lewis on a daily basis and had taught Lewis on an intense schedule for about 4 months. He later wrote that, by the beginning of 1803, "I had now had opportunities of knowing him intimately." Jefferson gave his reasons for picking Lewis to Dr. Benjamin Rush of Philadelphia. "Captain Lewis is brave."